Hello, everybody. I'm Hadar Suskin. I'm the campaign director for the Hatikva Slate. Welcome to this webinar hosted by Partners for Progressive Israel and co-sponsored by Americans for Peace Now and the National Council of Jewish Women. Thank you so much for joining us. Over the next 60 minutes or so, I will be serving as your moderator, which makes a lot of sense because I'm serving as campaign director for this slate. So there it is. Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that Partners for Progressive Israel, Americans for Peace Now, and National Council of Jewish Women are all part of the Hatikva slate running in these World Zionist Congress elections. Voting started a week ago, and it goes until March 11th. So if you haven't voted yet, please, please do so, and please encourage friends, family, colleagues, and everybody you know to do so. It's ZionistElection.org is the website, and please vote Hatikva, which is slate number 8. Okay, first I'm gonna start off by introducing today's panelists. Nancy Kaufman, Nancy, you can wave, is the past CEO of the National Council of Jewish Women and a member of the Hatikva Progressive Israel Slate. She's a veteran Jewish community leader, and I will take a point of personal prerogative here and say also we share the same birthday. So hello, Nancy. And our second panelist today is Chagit Ofran. Chagit is the co-director of the Settlement Watch Project of Israel of Israeli Peace Now Movement, Shalom Achshav. And for those of you who might not know Chagit, she is widely recognized as really the foremost expert on a range of issues relating to the West Bank settlements, occupation, and really settlement-related development in East Jerusalem. So we're very, very happy to have both of you with us today. What we're gonna do, just process-wise, is the three of us will share some information with you for maybe 25, 30 minutes or so, after which we'll be taking questions from the audience. I want to make clear to everyone that you can type your questions in right now. If you go to the bottom of your screen, and you may need to move your mouse there to where it says Q&A, you can go ahead and type questions in. Everybody other than the panelists is muted, so that's how we're going to be taking the questions, and we'll get to them throughout the discussion and then at the end there. That is it. All right. So. With that, I'm going to kick us off and get us started. So again, as I mentioned, I am the campaign for the director for the Hatikva Slate. So you might ask, what exactly is this Hatikva Slate? Well, it is a coalition of 11 national organizations, obviously Partners for Progressive Israel, Peace Now, and National Council of Jewish Women, as we mentioned, but joined by a really incredible array of progressive American Jewish voices, Amenu, Aleph, J Street, Trua, NIF, who am I forgetting, Habonim, HaShomer, and Jewish Labor Committee are all part of this process and part of this campaign, along with a really, really incredible list of, you know, of individual Jewish leaders who've joined on to be part of this effort. And for those of you who are familiar with this process and who have, you know, paid attention to Hatikva, you'll know that the slate has existed in previous elections, but it's really a very, very different thing this time because we've built this incredibly big, incredibly broad progressive coalition. And the purpose of this coalition is to run within the World Zionist Congress elections. So a little background, a little frame around that. These elections are taking place, as I said, right now until March 11th. They happen every 5 years. And what they do is they elect the American representatives, the US representatives, to the World Zionist Congress. Now, the Congress will take place this coming October in Jerusalem. There will be 500 total delegates there. Of those 500, 152 come from the United States delegation. So we are running a lot as one of 15 slates, and we are the progressive wing of that whole broad range of organizations. And we're really running because we understand how important it is to make sure that a strong progressive Jewish voice shows up in this space. And you know, there are a lot of people in this country, a lot of American Jews, including some who've been very involved in Jewish life and Jewish organizations for decades, who when I first reach out to them and talk to them about this, say, well, you know, I've heard of that, but the only thing I know about the World Zionist Congress is, you know, Herzl and old guys with beards. What is this thing? I didn't know that that still exists. And that's part of the problem. That's part of the challenge that we face, is that for a long, long time, not that many people within the American Jewish community have paid attention to this. In the last elections 5 years ago, just under 57,000 total people voted, which, you know, is basically a small city council race. So the numbers have been very small. And the people who did pay attention to this, no surprise, more of them were the more conservative elements of our community. And that means that they ended up with more power in this space. So I think the fair question to ask is, well, so what? What does it mean to have more power? Well, we're going to dig into some of the details and what it means on the ground and what it means for the community. But I actually want to start us off with one number that helps explain it. And that number is 1 billion. And that is the total budget of the four national institutions that are impacted, that are either controlled or partially controlled by the results of these elections. And given that these elections happen only once every 5 years, it's actually $5 billion. So what we're talking about here is a process that is going to directly impact how $5 billion are spent and whether that money is spent over the green line in the occupied territories or whether that money is spent on social service issues or on other things within Israel. It impacts money that's spent in Jewish communities around the globe for education, on so many other issues. So as we get into the details, just know that the frame of this is a $1 billion annual budget and who ends up having say over how that's spent. So what I wanna do now is turn it over. We're gonna start with Nancy. And Nancy, I'd really like for you to tell us a little bit. Nancy is one of those individual free agent leaders who has added her name and her voice to this effort. So talk to us about, you know, why you decided to do that.
Thank you, Hadar, and thank you for all your work. This is, you have raised up the bar in terms of people's understanding of the importance of the World Zionist Congress. So as Hadar said, I recently stepped down as CEO of the National Council of Jewish Women. I continue as a life member, advisor, and supporter. And so I'm here wearing that former hat. Prior to that, I served for 20 years as the JCRC director in Boston for the Boston Jewish community. And I am here, quite frankly, because I am inspired by the very progressive Declaration of Independence of the State of Israel, which gave rise to this whole thing. And I am particularly inspired because, unlike in our own country here in the United States, that Declaration of Independence actually states that the new State of Israel would be based on the precepts of liberty, justice, and peace, as taught by the prophets, and would uphold the full social and political equality of all citizens. That's how it was worded. Without distinction of race, creed, or sex, which was pretty visionary and progressive of the founding fathers, and they were fathers, and that the new state will guarantee full freedom of conscience, worship, education, and culture. So it is for those reasons that I believe and have believed and always believed in viability and the importance of a state. Similarly, that's why I wear many hats. I wear the hat of being a progressive Zionist feminist who is concerned about the plight of Palestinians. And I feel I can hold all those identities, even though some would question how is that possible. I believe it is possible. So that is sort of why I am here. I happen to feel very, very strongly that what is happening now in Israel on a number of issues that I have worked on my whole life and are deeply concerned about need to be addressed. And when you're talking about $1 billion, as Hadar says, and 5 billion over 5 years, you know, we have the ability to actually have some power. And there are not many levers that we have the ability to have power in terms of many of us don't vote in Israel and the elections, but this is a place where the diaspora Jewish community has been engaged and has power. So, you know, since power is never given, it's always taken. I think what this is we are stepping up and stepping into to taking our power that is there for the asking, but has never really been acted on. So what do I mean by that? And what are some of the issues that I specifically care about that I think we all should be thinking about and why we should vote for this slate? Well, it's pretty direct. I mean, if you just read our slate, you will see that we are worried about gender equality. We are worried about full legal and social equality for the LGBTQI community, including marriage rights. We are concerned about how asylum seekers are treated and how foreign workers are treated, and are they being treated with the dignity that they deserve. We're worried about racism in Israeli society and fighting racism, whether it be against Jews of color or people of other faiths. We want to promote environmental sustainability, something of deep concern, and we want to work with Palestinians in the territories and neighboring countries to deal with the situation there. We at MTJW believe in a two-state solution. We believe that Israel, if she's going to be able to continue as a Jewish democratic state, the only alternative is a two-state solution, and are deeply concerned about the move towards a one-state solution. And if and when that happens, the question that I always raise is, which state is it going to be, a democratic state or a Jewish state? And which is the state you want to support, a democratic or a Jewish, if you had to choose? And that is a choice I don't think many of us want to make. We're aligned with the values and policies of all the groups that are in this are aligned together. We're obviously also aligned with other slates in terms of the reform movement, and we can talk more about that in the Q&A, because that does come up as a question. So these are some of the reasons that I decided to sign on. I think we have I think voting in this election and cutting through the fact you have to pay $750. Someone said to me, isn't that a poll tax? But that's what it costs to operate the election.
$7.50.
That's what I said, $7.50. I think is a small price to pay in order to have a voice, in order to potentially really influence the money. I particularly, to just drill down a little more, I'm concerned about gender equity in Israel. Some of the recent moves, the control and power of the rabbinate, gender separation, but not just that, equal pay for equal work, the role of women in elected office and locally and nationally, the fact that there's over 100 organizations, women-led organizations now in Israel, and what's the gender index, and there's work being done now in the gender direction in terms of budget, and the issue of religious pluralism, and the fact that we know that, unlike in the United States, where we supposedly have a separation of religion and state, Israel doesn't, so that means an inordinate power and control by the rabbinate. So where is the money going? And the money that we who do not vote in Israel and do not elect members of Knesset don't have direct control over the budget of the government of Israel. We do have control over the budget of the World Zionist Congress. And so if we exercise that, think about the difference we could make in terms of what we can control. And so I don't think $1 billion is anything to take lightly. And it's important. I am very proud to be on the Hatikva slate with over 50% women represented on the slate.
67 women and 62 men.
Thank you, Hadass. 67 women and 62 men. Appreciate that. And your vote will be really important, because the more of you who vote, the more of us will get to be represented in the World Zionist Congress. And it will be a first for many of us. And something that many of our eyes have been open to in a way that we never took seriously. And I think now we're taking it seriously, because those of us who are activists, those of us who have been advocates all our life, need to find the places we can actually make a difference and make our voices heard. And while that can be frustrating because it's not everywhere, let's find those places. I think this is one of them. I think the Hatikva slate is a means to an end. And I think that the World Zionist Congress is a place where we could really be a presence, be an influence, and make a difference. So that's why I'm on the Hatikva slate, and I'm proud to be. And I, again, hope that you all will ask you questions, but most importantly, vote.
Thank you so much, Nancy. And more than that, thank you for being on the HaTikvah slate and all the work you're doing. You know, a couple of things that came up for me as Nancy was talking, she noted the gender equity issue, and that's definitely something that has been really central for HaTikvah. And, you know, Nancy mentioned the number of women on the slate. That's not an accident. It was only a decade ago that the World Zionist Organization actually put in a rule mandating that at least 30% of all the delegates on every slate be women, because up until then, it wasn't even 30%. So that was, I guess, progress for them. But for us, the very first conversation we had about putting together the HaTikvah slate was that, you know, for we were committed to having at least 50% women. That was clear that that was something that we were going to do. And along with that, we wanted our slate to be representative of our broad progressive agenda overall. So that includes the gender equity piece. But we also, I think, are the one slate that really reached out to Jews of color and to that part of our community to be part of this effort. It's a place where, as I discussed before, you know, only a minority element of the community has really been very active, and Jews of color were certainly not really part of that. And likewise with environmental sustainability, you mentioned we've got folks on the slate who have been leaders in that realm and so many others. And, you know, to go back to the basic issue, Israel, and what does that future look like? You know, obviously all of this is happening right now within the context of the Trump-Netanyahu announcement yesterday and, you know, a looming vote coming up. And as Nancy said, for those who are not Israeli citizens, who don't vote there, you know, this is a way to have your voice heard. And I'm sure everyone on this call has probably heard also that, you know, the criticism of saying, well, as an American Jew, you know, why are you trying to what happens there? Why are you sticking your nose into what happens there? You know, you shouldn't be doing that. But, you know, obviously Theodore Herzl disagreed because he set up this process specifically to be the parliament of the Jewish people. And there actually really is a clear answer to that, that this money, this $1 billion or $5 billion that we're talking about, you know, just to be clear, is not controlled, is not the World Zionist Congress or the World Zionist Organization. It's the budget of the World Zionist Organization, but much larger than that, it's also the budget of the Jewish Agency for Israel, whose leaders are largely appointed through this process, and World JNF, again, whose leaders are appointed through this process, and the Keren HaYesod. So it's those four national institutions whose collective budget equals the $1 billion that we're talking about, and can have a real influence. And, you know, we talk about influence on lots of different things, but again, to get into those specific details about, you know, what's the influence on settlements, what's the influence on, you know, issues around annexation and occupation. So, you know, Nancy and I could talk about that, but much better, we've brought somebody who's there, who's on the ground, who is, you know, one of the most respected experts in the world on this topic. So Hagit, I would like to turn to you for that part of the conversation. I mean, given the really sort of Byzantine nature of the WZO and those national institutions that I was talking about, I think it's hard for a lot of people here to understand what is this look like when we talk about impact on the ground. So can you talk us through that a little bit? What is it, you know, what does that mean? What could be different? What could be better if we had a bigger say and if we had more power and control over things like the JNF?
Yeah, well, the World Zionist Organization, or the Congress, the World Zionist Congress, actually decides how those organizations would look like, especially the JNF, Keren HaKayemet, the Jewish Agency, as you said. And those organizations has impact on things that has to do with the Israeli settlement activity. Specifically, in recent years, we see that settlers or right-wing organizations or individuals are taking advantage of those organizations and their money in order to encourage settlement activity. And this is something that can easily be changed if you have a different makeup in the World Zionist Congress. And I would like to take you through two main organizations. The first one is the Keren HaKayemet, the JNF. Throughout the history, since 1967, the JNF did projects in settlements. And like the Jewish Agency and like other Jewish organizations, they said, we are active wherever Israel is active, and therefore settlements are included in that. However, how much you invest there, or if at all you invest in areas that are not part of Israel, it's something that the board of the JNF, of the Keren HaKayemet, can decide. And there were years that it was more involved in settlement activity, years less involved. What we see, what was exposed several months ago, was that secretly, within the Keren HaKayemet, they managed to take almost 100 million shekels from the JNF in order to purchase land from Palestinians in the West Bank. This is highly, highly problematic in terms of Israel's policy in the West Bank, in terms of the chances for peace. Those purchases, the buying land, is something always very problematic. A lot of monkey business has to do with that. And eventually, it's settlers who want to set facts on the ground, for instance, in the heart of Hebron, and they need a lot of money in order to buy a house or a land in order to settle there. And they found this pocket money from this huge organization that you don't need to fundraise. You have it already, the Keren HaKayemet. You just, what you need is to have the board of the JNF allow you to take this money. In the specific case of what was exposed, they even didn't bring it to the board of the JNF. They did it through a subsidiary of the JNF. And now things are in a lot of debate, and the reform movement, or the representatives of the reform movements who sit in the board of the JNF, who were voted because of the results of the previous elections in the World Zionist Congress, they are pushing now to undo or to block this land purchase issue. However, they tell me they don't have enough votes in the board, so it's not so easy to stop it. So, in one decision, there is another issue, very dramatic, that the JNF is doing. Historically, the Keren HaKayemet managed to get properties from the government of Israel through a very problematic process, using the absentee property law, taking over Palestinian properties in East Jerusalem, specifically in Silwan, and through the JNF giving it to the settlers, and based on lands they got back in 1990, or it's not land, it's houses of Palestinians where Palestinian families are living, they are now suing families out of their home. And specifically, there is the Sumerin family case. I don't know if you heard of it, but it's something very, very annoying that the Jewish National Fund, that is supposed to represent the Jewish people, is actually chasing a poor Palestinian family who happened to live in Silwan, which is a few hundred meters from the old city, where they were born in this house. But back in the 80s, the house was declared absentee property and was given to the JNF. And now they have to fight in court in order to prevent their eviction. And this fight is going on for more than 20 years. And recently they lost their case. They have a evacuation order. They appealed, but this horrible story could have been prevented very easily had it been a decision in the JNF to leave them alone and to say it is not part of the purposes of the Jewish National Fund to kick out Palestinians from their homes in order to bring in Israeli settlers. It's so, and we cannot get the current board of JNF to stop it. But I believe that soon, after the elections of the World Zionist Congress, the setup of this board might be different. So that's two urgent examples of how the JNF is used for settlement activity. There is also a body that belongs to the World Zionist Organization. It's called the Settlement Division. It was established in early 70s in order to help the government of Israel to build the settlements. And it was actually meant to allow the government to do things that governments cannot do, to take over lands, to allocate lands behind the scenes with no transparency, without the due process, and allocate money to projects that are not legal. And this is a body that is fully funded by the State of Israel. I'm talking about the Settlement Division, but it's not a governmental body. So it's not under any transparency or any rules of a government. And they are continuing all the time not only to allocate money for controversial projects in the West Bank, but sometimes even involved in a land grab and giving settlers papers as if they own land that they never owned and things of the sort. We wrote about it at length in the last year, and it's on our website, on Peace Now's website. So if you're interested into this body, I encourage you to go read it. So I believe that you have an opportunity here that relatively easily, not a lot of effort, to vote for a tikva and to make a change in those bodies. And in my perspective, to change the policies of those bodies in settlements.
Excellent. Hagit, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us. It's a lot, and it's complicated. It's a lot to take in there. You know, I think I started off, I threw out the $1 billion number, and you know, Nancy talked about the money also, but it's really important to understand that, you know, in America, we all, in politics, people often say, you know, show me your budget and you show me your values, right? The money is the policy. Right, where that money goes or where that money doesn't go isn't just a number. It's deciding, as Hagit was talking about, whether, you know, land is being illicitly purchased and taken from Palestinians and given to settlers, when that same money, you know, could be used for, you know, a battered women's shelter in South Tel Aviv. That same money that sometimes goes to, you know, a fence in some settlement out there could go toward helping build, you know, an after-school center for kids in the Negev, in the Galil, in other places. You know, and these budgets, it's important to talk about where this money comes from, too. We talk about that $1 billion. That money is raised from us, from the Jewish community globally. And whether you give directly to the Jewish Agency or to the JNF, and, you know, it is... you know, it is the global JNF, which is now a separate entity from the U.S. JNF. But, you know, maybe you give to those institutions directly, or people, you know, you give to those institutions, but also federations give allocations to those institutions. So if you give to your local federation, some of that money is going into this. So the reason, right? The reason we have a vote in this, the reason we have a say in this is because it really is money raised globally and money spent globally. It's also about, you know, education. When the Jewish Agency sends shlichim around the country, around the world, pardon me, you know, the question of who are they sending? It used to be that those people were almost universally Orthodox men, and that was who was going out to communities to educate people about what Israel is and what Israel means. And needless to say, they brought their own views and their own ideology with them. You know, one spot where we've had some success already, we need more, but where we've built some power is in the department that deals with that. And we've now seen, you know, we've now seen that change. Whereas there are still some Orthodox men, which that's fine, but there are lots of non-Orthodox and there are lots of women and there are even non-Jews, right, who get sent out to be part of this process. So it's really important to understand where that money comes from, where it goes. I wanna take a minute again to remind everybody to please type your questions into the Q&A. They can be questions about the slate or the elections and the process or the on-the-ground impact, you know, and any of those pieces. So I'm gonna take the first question here, which is, can the World Zionist Congress be used as a tool to promote Jewish-Arab equality in Israel? Does its budget go just to Jewish Israelis or to all Israelis? So that's a great question. I think the answer is an unequivocal yes. It certainly can be used for that. Again, the money that is controlled, this $1 billion, is the total budget of the World Zionist Organization, the Jewish Agency, the JNF, and the Karen Yesod, and they run programs around the country and around the world for all different audiences. So even just starting to talk about, you know, we spent some time talking about where that money goes, where we don't want it to go in terms of settlements. But then it could go other places and it could go to things. Some of it does go and more of it could go to things that are promoting that kind of cooperation and promoting, you know, coexistence. So the details of literally where all of those dollars goes breaks down through all of those organizations, but there's no doubt that there can be a big impact there. Hagit, I don't know if you have anything you want to add on that.
I don't know the distribution to which organizations. I can see in reports of organizations that they get money from Jewish Agency or Keren Hayesod and things of a sort. And sometimes I see it in right-wing organizations and sometimes I see it in more progressive organizations. The thing is that we all NGOs, all activists, we all struggle to collect money to be able to do what we want. And I just don't want it to be that there is this pile of money that is in the hands of the right wing to do whatever they want. I want it to be for Jewish purposes that are less controversial, or at least that my voice will be heard when they divide this money.
Right. Hadar, you may want to say a little more about how much of many federations' budgets that are raised, money that's raised for Israel through the federation, actually ends up with the Jewish Agency and then gets distributed. Because it's a large proportion, I believe, of their overseas budget.
Nancy, that's a great point. I have to be honest, I don't know off the top of my head the percentage. You know, Jewish federations for decades and decades have been raising money and sending it to Israel. Right. And this is where that goes. I mean, there are federations that have, in addition, individual projects and partnerships with institutions. But, you know, largely when the federation right. system raises money, which is hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right.
That money goes to these organizations. So it is something that anyone in the Jewish community, anyone who's a federation donor, but frankly, anyone who's involved in that community at all has a stake in and is a part of. I've got another question here, which is a great one. And it's asking us to say more about the role of Artsa, the reform movement slate. It says past and present. It says concerning Hatikva issues, especially promoting / blocking people. So that's a really good question. I'm going to take the opportunity to give the frame a little bit. I mentioned that there are 15 different slates running. So there are, I would say, two that I would consider, you know, as our, broadly speaking, our coalition partners and allies. And that's the reform movement and the conservative movement. And, you know, we I don't know that we could come up with anything where we have a policy, sort of a platform disagreement. We tend to sit in coalition. At the end, after these elections, all the US representatives will sit in global coalition with our partners and allies sort of along ideological lines. So we have traditionally been with the Reform and Conservative movement. As long as they continue to sit with the Merits, Labor, sort of progressive coalition, we will certainly continue to sit with them. The distinction I would say is this. So I think they're, you know, good people and good slates and doing good work. The distinction is this. We sit in coalition with them, but we are the progressive edge of that coalition. Both ARTSA and Merkaz, the conservative, or the Reform and Conservative movements, this part's really important. In this space, within the frame of the World Zionist Congress, they really, really focus on funding stream, on their funding stream issues, the funding for denominational movements. Because a lot of this money goes to denominational movements, both in Israel and as part of the education budget around the world. And first of all, HaTikva supports them in that. We want to see them getting this money. So we vote with them, we support them in doing that. But understandably, because it's about dollars for their institutions and their, you know, their brick and mortar, as they talk about it, that's really where their focus area is. So when it comes to issues around settlements, you know, for example, since you asked about that, they're certainly not pro-settlement, obviously not. They're with us at large, but that's not where they're leading, and that's not where they're fighting. And likewise, on a lot of these other issues, when it comes to LGBT issues, when it comes to gender equity issues, again, the Reform movement overall is great on those things. The Conservative movement is very, very good on those things. If, you know, the movements are great. In the WZO space, that's not where their energy goes. So, you know, for people who feel like their real prime Jewish affiliation is with their synagogue and their synagogue movements, and they want to make sure that they're getting as much funding as possible for, you know, conservative rabbis in Israel or Reform shuls in Israel, et cetera, and they want to support Arza or Merkaz, great, go for it. We'll be in coalition at the end. Obviously, like I said, HaTikva supports too. But if you want to really be supporting the slate that is pushing for the progressive, the broad progressive agenda and fighting for that, it's definitely HaTikva. It's worth noting in terms of Merkaz that there was actually an article about the election a few weeks ago that said, you know, HaTikva, Arza, and Merkaz all support a two-state solution. And Merkaz actually asked for a correction that said the conservative movement supports, you know, peace with the Palestinians. It's not specific about how. So they actually kind of went out of their way to distance themselves from that, which was interesting. So we've got another question here about whether we can support the Reform and Conservative movement when it comes to recognizing these streams in Israel, proper prayer spaces at the wall. This was asked by Ellen. The answer again is 100% yes. You know, religious pluralism is very much part of our platform. It's very important. We've got 13 rabbis from across different denominations on our slate, and you know, far beyond the rabbis, obviously, it's something we care about. Okay. Okay, Nancy, here's a question specifically for you. It says, Nancy, I agree that you can wear all of the hats that you do, but some might say the Zionist hat does not fit with the other hats. What would you say to those people who have a problem with Zionism?
Well, that's their prerogative. If they have a problem with Zionism, they may not be interested in the World Zionist Congress, and that's okay. You know, we're not asking everyone, every Jew in the diaspora to want to support this. This is the World Zionist Congress. It was in, you know, the envisioned by Herzl. It was begun by Herzl. And, you know, I'm offering my personal feeling that I think you can hold all those identities, but we only can hold all those identities if the Zionism that we believe in is a Zionism that meets the basic tenets of the Declaration of Independence, which is why I started with that. In other words, liberty and justice and equal rights for all of her citizens and lifting up the role of women and irregardless of you know, sexual orientation, religion, et cetera. So I think that's a very personal question. I would not, you know, if someone does not consider themselves a Zionist, then this may not be the right place for them. And I understand that, but appreciate the question.
Yeah. Thank you, Nancy. And it's worth it. I didn't lay out, you know, the voting criteria for this. In order to be eligible to vote, there are some really basic things. So first of all, you do have to be Jewish. It is the parliament of the Jewish people. That is very clearly a non-descriptive, self-identified Jewish. So you have to be Jewish, you have to be 18 or older, and it's actually 18 by June 30th of this year, of 2020. So that's basically anybody who's a high school senior this year and older. You have to live in the United States. It is not a legal citizenship question, but you have to live here. So we actually have a whole sub-campaign for Israelis here in the US, and that's because there are elections in many, many different countries. And so it's not a citizenship question, it's a location question. You do, as Nancy mentioned, have to pay this small processing fee. It's $7.50 or $5 if you're 25 or under. All of that money goes to pay for the cost of the elections. It is not a donation to the WZO or the AZM or Hatikva or anybody else. It literally pays for this to be able to happen. And then there is a piece that I think we mentioned really briefly. You have to click on in support, and this goes to the question about Zionism, of something called the Jerusalem Program, which is basically the platform of the World Zionist Organization. And I'll say, you know, for myself as a Slate member, and I know for many, many of the people who are on the Slate and voting for the Slate, you know, it's not language we love. It's kind of dusty old language. And the truth is, folks on the right don't love it either. It's been modified over the years, and it's always a contentious, process between the left and the right and all the different slates and all the different voices. But being willing to click on that and say, okay, you know, I can live with those basic tenets is part of being eligible. So for anyone who says that they're not a Zionist, whether they're Jewish or non-Jewish, this is obviously not their playing field. Okay, Chagit, we've got one for you here. It says, Chagit, dream a little bit. What would you like to see the WZC do in October to support you and the work that you do? And I'm going to expand that a little bit, because again, the Congress takes place in October, and a lot of important work done there and resolutions that help drive the work of the World Zionist Organization. But take that and expand it to, you know, the organizations that are impacted and whose leadership is determined by the Congress.
Look, if I need to dream and go far, I would say the World Zionist Organization will inform the government of Israel that they stop being their subcontractor to the dirty work of settlement activity. Meaning that if the government of Israel wants to do all what the settlement division is doing for it, by, you know, managing land and financing projects, if the World Zionist Organization will declare, okay, but not through our organization, not through our bureaucracy, then it will be very, very important move. But it's, I think, politically, it's going to be very hard, although it's so just. And in the JNF, if they would leave the Samarin family, if they would stop the land purchase, I didn't mention all what they do. The JNF was involved in going to courts in order to demand demolition of Palestinian homes in the West Bank. Things that really, I think as a Jew, I cannot really support. I think the Jewish agency, the World Zionist Organization, is important. Its voice is important because the state of Israel is the state of the Jewish people, and it's part of our discourse. And there are so many fields that I want our voice to be heard, and not that it will be like a tool in the hands of those who just, you know, they vote, so they have the power to use it. So if we vote, maybe we can have more power.
That sounds good. Thank you, Chagit. We've got one more question here. It says, does the World Zionist Congress have leverage over the Netanyahu government in terms of stopping the annexation he's about to move forward with? So let me start with that and then sort of open the discussion. The World Zionist, neither the World Zionist Organization nor any of the entities we've been talking about has the power to stop that, right? That comes down to the Knesset, that comes down to Israeli voters. You know, unfortunately, that's not something that we can do in this capacity. But, and this is where I'll sort of open it from there, and Hagit and Nancy, feel free to weigh in here too. We have seen examples where the World Zionist Organization and the entities involved have the ability to pressure the government on certain things. So the way, for example, Nancy referenced refugees and asylum seekers and foreign workers, you know, there was a case where the way the government was dealing with those populations, you know, the leadership within the World Zionist Organization and some of these entities spoke up publicly and disagreed with them, and pressured them, and got them to really to change their position and to take different actions. Now, again, I want to go back. It's not going to stop, right? It's the Knesset's job and to weigh in on what Netanyahu is going to do or not do. That's not the role of the World Zionist Organization, but it does have the ability to pressure. To pressure publicly in a number of different ways on a lot of different topics. Hagit, do you want to add anything in on that? Or Nancy, do you want to add anything?
No, it's a perfect perfect answer. Just to mention that annexation doesn't even need legislation. So it can be a decision of the cabinet. And Israel is a sovereign state. However, as you said, the World Zionist Organization, the knew how to raise its voice in the past in things that were important to it. Again, we're talking about annual $1 billion. It's important, and the Jewish voice is important. So if we cannot stop it technically, but we can affect dramatically the decision.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay, I don't have any more questions at the moment. So I want to again thank everybody for joining us. And thank you obviously Hagit and Nancy for taking your time and doing this and for all of the work that you're doing. Ultimately, most importantly, I want to urge all of you on this call to please, please, please go right now and vote for Hatikva. I put the website into the chat. Hatikvaslate.net takes you to our website where you can see everyone on the slate, you can see more information, all the press coverage, the platform that Nancy referenced, et cetera. And you can link there to the step-by-step instructions for how to vote. Unfortunately, the voting process is a little clunky. Or you can just go directly to ZionistElection.org, which is the website that's actually managing this. Go through, register, and vote. Please make sure you vote. Slate number 8 is Hatikva. And then, you know, a lot of these other slates, particularly we've talked about Arza and Merkaz, but some of these others that have, you know, built-in constituencies of denominations, et cetera, that's how they're doing their outreach. They've got a lot of resources that are going into this election. You know, for us, this is really people-powered. We've got our 11 national partners, and we've got an incredible list of 129 leaders like Nancy who are part of this. But what we have is all of you. And so please vote. Please share on social media that you've voted. Urge people to vote for Hatikva. Email them, neighbors, family, friends, people you went to high school with who you don't even like, whoever it is. You know, we need them to come out and vote. So I also just want to make sure we thank the staff of Partners for Progressive Israel for putting this together. You can also go to progressiveisrael.org to learn more about partners and about their leadership and involvement in Hatikva. And with that, I will say thank you and goodbye.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.